It's Thursday, August 13th. Polls can be deceiving, and it's not ancient herstory. We start here.
Case against Donald Trump and Mike Pence is open and shut.
As Joe Biden and Kamala Harris make their first campaign appearance together.
Biden kind of has like a northern path and a southern path to victory, and he probably only needs one.
We ask 538's Nate Silver how he rates their chances. Meanwhile, President Trump reiterates schools should reopen.
How are they going to deal with mask bullying?
But tell that to the districts that are quickly closing back up again. What parents need to know. Protesters in Belarus tell police, there's more of us than there are of you.
They've been able to actually chase these heavily armed riot officers.
Is a decades-old dictatorship on Russia's doorstep about to come crashing down? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. This is usually the most exciting moment a presidential campaign can have on a day that votes aren't on the line. The moment you select a running mate, that is the moment you kind of cement what kind of race you're going to run. It's a chance for the party to get amped, it's a chance for staffers to churn into high gear, and for supporters to come together. But this is 2020. People aren't getting together for anything.
And good afternoon. We're coming on the air right now because we are about to see the Democratic ticket in this race for the White House for the first time.
And so in a high school gym yesterday in Wilmington, Delaware, former Vice President Joe Biden met with whom he hopes will become his vice president, Senator Kamala Harris. They chatted through face masks backstage, and then together in navy blue suits, they made their way out for their first appearance together.
Kamala, as you all know, she's smart, she's tough, she's experienced, she's a proven fighter.
Case against Donald Trump and Mike Pence is open and shut.
This might have looked the same as a usual speech on TV. This was all done in front of a few dozen people, mostly reporters with big social distance circles around them. So there were no applause breaks during these speeches. They didn't even get to do that thing where you grab each other's hands and then stick them up in the air together. But the stretch run has now begun in earnest. So where does it stand? We've got the editor-in-chief of our partners at 538 with us this morning. Nate Silver's here. Nate, you guys put out your big forecasting model yesterday. So first question, biggest question, who's going to win this election?
We don't know, and our model doesn't know, and anyone who says they know built a bad model. Look, Joe Biden's ahead by a reasonably comfortable margin right now, about 8.5 points in polls. So the question is, how much do you really know from polls in August about what will happen in November, given various conditions that are going on in the world, some of which make the outcome more certain, right? There aren't that many undecided voters this year, but also less certain, like COVID-19. And the answer our model comes up with is that Biden is somewhere in the vicinity of a 71 or 72% chance to win the Electoral College.
We begin tonight with the countdown to Election Day. With just 16 days to go, Hillary Clinton is getting a big boost.
So ironically, 71% was exactly the same number that Hillary Clinton had at the end of the campaign in 2016.
I was going to say.
Yeah. So if you don't understand that, you know, that Trump at 29%, that 29% chances happen, well, 29% of the time, which is pretty often, then you don't have to go too far back in history to learn that lesson.
Well, and that's the question, because I keep hearing everyone at 538 stress, like, this is a forecast. This is the same as saying there's a 70% chance of rain. That's not necessarily how it shakes out. But is that a factor in how you guys talk about this now because of what happened in 2016? Because on the day of the election, when you hear Hillary Clinton's got an 80% chance of winning, you don't think that's a lock. But I do think a lot of Americans probably saw that and think, oh, it's a lock. So does that affect how you guys talk about the model or even built the model this time around?
It didn't really affect how we built the model. I mean, you know, we think the model did a good job because just like sometimes a player makes a flush in poker, right? You know, 30% chances are supposed to happen sometimes. And in fact, our model was much more bullish on Trump than others that put him at, you know, 1% or 5%.
You know, when the Huffington Post really doesn't even want to put him in the political category, even they said they're going to put him right next
in
to the Kardashians and the Bachelorette.
Yeah.
They're no,
like.
These are sideshow.
Yeah. Like, I think if we're being honest, though, it's partly like, you know, people come to the election with preconceptions. Mm. I think a lot of people on the coasts came to 2016 with the preconception that Clinton would beat Trump, and they thought that Trump was kind of, you know, a circus act and didn't take him seriously. And that conditioned how they read polls and forecasts, right? Because people had no problem in 2018, When we had our House forecast with Democrats having an 80% chance or 83%, they had no trouble saying, well, that's a long way from 100%. And so I think, like, it's a bit more complicated than that, right? I think this year, because of 2016, that people get that, you know, polls aren't always perfectly right, that Trump could win another term.
Well, and so the thing everyone's going to be talking about, of course, is like that big number at the top of your forecast or the big national polls, right? But the fun stuff in your model, I think, is even further down, because like my favorite thing to look at is the snake, right, where you guys put states in order of how safe they are for Republicans or Democrats. And right in the middle are all the ones that are very much up for grabs. Can you break that down for me? Because like right now, you guys have Florida as an easier pickup for Joe Biden than like Arizona. Why is that? How are you guys thinking in terms of states?
So if you think about it, Biden kind of has like a northern path and a southern path to victory, and he probably only needs one. The northern path would mean that you flip Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania back into the D column, hold Minnesota. At that point, if you've won those states, doesn't matter whether you win Iowa or Ohio, although he could. Those states are close, too. That would give him the map that Clinton was kind of supposed to have in 2016.
The former vice president swept 10 out of 15 Super Tuesday contests, including upsets in Minnesota and even Texas.
And the other route is a kind of Sun Belt strategy where you win. I mean, Florida has 29 electoral votes on its own. So if you win Florida, you can lose a lot of other states and you're in pretty good shape. If you win some combination of Florida, Arizona, and North Carolina, then that suffices to win the election. Then you have more exotic stuff like Georgia and Texas.
Well, can I just point out that like one of the states that are not on this list is California, right? That's a deep blue state. That's where Kamala Harris is from, right? So with, can I go to the VP pick? What does she add to these states like Arizona or Florida or Wisconsin or Michigan? I mean, how does this factor into the race?
I'm not sure that she'll be a huge factor. VPs normally aren't.
Right.
Look, I think Biden is making sure that you won't upset any kind of major part of the Democratic base. I know there are some people on the left who would have preferred Warren, Elizabeth Warren or something, right? But it's kind of a pick you make when you think, hey, look, I don't need to hit a home run here. I just need to hit a solid double and have somebody that my base will be excited about. You could have picked Gretchen Whitmer or something in Michigan.
Right, one of these light blue things. That's what I would think.
But they only make a point or two worth of difference anyway, usually, the VP. Okay. And so it's like, that wouldn't necessarily override a 50-state consideration.
Okay, so the last question for you then. What are you seeing from the Trump campaign at this point then? And like, what is that in line with what he needs to do to claw these states back?
I suppose I would caution against presuming that the president's choices are necessarily strategic as opposed to instinctual. Look, he doesn't have a great hand to play.
It's going away now. It'll go away. Like things go away. Absolutely. It's no question in my mind. It will go away. Please, go ahead. Hopefully sooner rather than later.
COVID has killed 150,000 Americans and counting, and people give him really bad marks for that. People think anytime he weighs in on the protests that it makes things worse. The economy is obviously currently in bad shape, although there's some signs of recovery. What he has to bank on probably is that like there's a recovery in both COVID and the economy by November, and then he might have a fighting chance, right? So if I were him, I would think, how can I get COVID cases down?
Twitter even saying Cory Booker will be running housing and having low-income housing invade the suburbs. It's clear that race is on the ballot.
And I might just kind of stay quiet about other things. I mean, one thing about Trump is like when he vocalizes something, creates more problems for himself.
President Trump is now publicly embracing a Republican candidate for Congress from Georgia with a history of making racist, anti-Semitic, and anti-Muslim statements. Marjorie Taylor Greene is also an outspoken supporter of the so-called QAnon conspiracy theory.
He tends to gain in polls in weeks when he is more quiet and other people are making news. So, you know, if I were him, I would get Dr. Fauci on the line and say, what can we do to like be able to tell a real, true recovery story for COVID and the economy by November? I'm not sure that's what Trump is going to do, but like that would be, I think, his best way to battle back.
Yeah, and I should say ABC News and Ipsos put a lightning fast poll into the field right after this VP announcement to gauge how people feel about Kamala Harris. Out of Biden, Trump, and Mike Pence, she is the only one of the four where more people approve and disapprove. So off to a good start in that regard. Nate Silver with 538. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Next up on Start Here, you don't have to wait until October. The debate to watch is the one on opening schools. So what should parents be looking for? That's after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
As Dr. Anthony Fauci has said, you can think of this as a huge COVID-19 outbreak in this country, but you could also think of it as dozens or even hundreds of smaller outbreaks. Each state has its own rules. Counties have their own rules.
We're following major developments in the debate over the use of face masks in North Central Florida.
In Marion County, Florida, not only are masks not required in public right now, a local sheriff has told his department his officers are not allowed to wear masks. Even if you're working at a big concert, he says, you are not allowed to wear one. And if you come into his office, you will be told to take your mask off or leave.
Woods writes, effective immediately. Any individual walking into any one of our lobbies that is wearing a mask will be asked to remove it.
And the South has been seen as the epicenter of the pandemic lately. Well, a new report from Policy Lab at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia shows all the signs of a new resurgence in the Northeast and the Midwest.
296 new cases, bringing the total of cases of COVID-19 in Massachusetts to 112,969.
Which is especially troubling since states like New York and New Jersey have paved the way for their schools to reopen, even though indoor dining still isn't allowed there. And yesterday, amid a surge of cases in states where schools have reopened, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy backed down, saying schools don't have to welcome students yet. They can go virtual if they want. Pressure is mounting on New York City to do the same thing. So with that, I want to bring in ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, because Dr. Ashton, obviously, there is no national policy for schools. There are barely state and local policies for schools. So I want to know, what should parents be thinking about and asking teachers or principals?
Well, when you come down to the issue of can schools reopen, it's really not a yes or no question. It's a it depends question. And parents, as well as students, as well as educators, need to all be involved in trying to find the answer. So let's start with parents.
I feel very fortunate. We have the resources that we need. We have computers, we have internet, but the bigger picture stresses me out so much.
My first medical and parental recommendation would be, it depends on the age of your child or children.
If I could afford to move out of Gwinnett County, I would. Just to put my kids in a different school district.
It depends on the medical issues that that child or children may have, that you or your family living in your household may have. And it depends on what's going on in your town, in your city, and in your state.
As of Friday, Philadelphia and its suburban counties in Pennsylvania are currently at a moderate risk level. Under state recommendations, school districts in that category are advised to use a blended hybrid learning model.
And then you have to ask, what are the resources that your school has that can help to mitigate or lower risk as low as possible?
I have two children that will be in North Guilford, 7th and 8th grade, which is one of the most overcrowded schools in the Harrison County School District. They are already riding 3-2 of us. They will not be able to social distance.
blessedly, children appear to face the lowest risk of all. It's 99.995% of all fatalities are adults. Think of that, 99.95.
I was going to say, the argument from President Trump and others have been, listen, young kids just simply do not get this virus as badly as adults do. I mean, do the numbers bear that out?
They are infected with SARS-CoV-2 or coronavirus at differing rates than older children. It might be younger children less susceptible than children over the age of 10. But the pediatric age group, 0 to 18, is absolutely not immune to COVID-19 disease.
It's probably the best study to date. And it does suggest that at least older kids transmit in ways that looks like, you know, more like adult-like transmission.
We know that they transmit it. We don't know how much or to what degree they transmit this virus. And so we can't just look at them in a vacuum.
What solutions are out there that do seem useful?
I would start with the basics, right? I would start with the basics of what the CDC and our top infectious disease and epidemiologists and public health officials have told us is effective in slowing this virus. And those are the so-called NPIs, non-pharmaceutical interventions of mask wearing, distancing of at least 6 feet apart, and hand hygiene. Now, when you talk about that in a classroom setting, it depends where you are in the country, right? I mean, if you're in a place that has good weather the majority of the academic year, then I would be thinking of finding all the resources I could to put a permanent tent outside so that you could hold a lot of classes outdoors where we know with the ventilation and outdoor environment.
So that is like a legitimate thing to bring up at a PTA meeting. Like that is not ridiculous.
Well, you're not going to see that as a CDC or WHO recommendation, Brad, right. But absolutely, I think that's legitimate. That's what's called thinking outside the box. That's what's called taking the common sense steps you can take to lower risk.
Right.
But then you get into resources. And obviously, if you're in an urban environment or resources are not the same for every school or every school district, that's not going to be feasible.
Outside of Baker Middle School and the kindergarten center, only a handful of students and families are seen wearing masks as they return back to school. Superintendent Sherry Brawlerson says the district will provide masks and face shields for teachers, but they are optional to wear.
You know, when it comes to masks in a school setting, Brad, masks have been a loaded issue for adults. Then when you talk about masks in the pediatric age group, you know, starting at age 2, which is what the CDC recommends, up to age 18, now you have to throw into the mix peer pressure. So schools are going to have to figure out, how are they going to enforce that? How are they going to deal with mask bullying if it exists? How will they deal with mask non-compliance? But at this point, the evidence is clear that masks absolutely cut the risk of transmission of this virus.
Tonight, the CDC director urging every American to wear a mask.
If we don't do that, as I said that last April, this could be the worst fall from a public health perspective we've ever had.
There might be a silver lining here, Brad. It might cut the rates of flu. And the most important thing, Brad, is not to be surprised or alarmed when there are cases.
Of those 1,100 quarantined, now cases are confirmed at 22 of Cherokee's 38 schools. And that number could increase because they're still waiting on test results.
This virus isn't going anywhere in the short term. So it's really a matter of asking the school, what is your plan when there are cases? Will we have to temporarily close? Will you close down a whole class?
A change of plans for students in Avon. After today, students here at the high school will be e-learning for the rest of the week.
Will all those students be self-quarantined? You know, those are the steps and the questions that really need to be worked out right now.
Yeah, and as we've seen officials, you know, pressing for schools, say, in Georgia to open, when those schools have closed quickly after those outbreaks, those same officials have not been as clear on what they think should actually be done differently going forward when they open back up. So Dr. Jennifer Ashton, thanks for the insight.
Thanks, Brad.
For all the protests that have rocked American cities this year, none of them have looked quite like what we are seeing in the country of Belarus. If you're picturing a map of Europe, Belarus sits smack in between Russia and Poland, but its leader has been in power even longer than Vladimir Putin. And in the 2 weeks since their elections, we've seen mass demonstrations, brutal crackdowns, and yet this has not played out the way many onlookers expected. ABC's Patrick Reval is based in Moscow. Patrick, what is different about these protests, this moment?
Yeah, I mean, this is really something we have never seen in Belarus. And, you know, I think one of the things that maybe people know about Belarus is it's known as one of the most repressive authoritarian places in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union.
Belarus has been correctly deemed the last dictatorship of Europe.
It's a very repressive place. And the idea that you could go out and even and demonstrate normally is something that isn't really a familiar idea. This all began essentially because there's an election, or there was an election in Belarus. And, you know, elections in Belarus are not normally particularly unpredictable affairs. You can tell who's going to win because the dictator who's been in charge in Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, has been in charge for 26 years.
Foreign observers have not judged an election to be free and fair in Belarus since 1995.
And then what happened unusually was that a woman who is married to a man who wanted to run, who's a popular blogger, and she stepped in after her husband was jailed. Her name is Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. A week or so before the election happened, we were seeing these huge, huge political rallies that we've never seen in Belarus since the end of the Soviet Union. And you could very much see that the Belarusian authorities were getting quite nervous about this election. So the election took place, and obviously the result, as usual, was 80% for Lukashenko. But what many, many people in Belarus know is that, of course, that 80% wasn't real. Almost immediately, people started trying to gather in the city centre, and the response was immediate from the authorities. They unleashed this just savage violence on people, throwing stun grenades into crowds. Very quickly, we saw rubber bullets being used, even running into people's homes sometimes, and clubbing people. The crowds themselves could almost not believe as when in these instances where they've been able to actually chase these heavily armed riot officers who ultimately have been, you know, terrorizing them. It's still an attempt to do peaceful protests that's being very violently dispersed. So the big question now is just whether the protesters can withstand that long enough to force a crisis and force him to step down, or will he actually just eventually bludgeon them into submission.
But then, Patrick, like, even if the protesters get what they want and their opposition candidate is declared the winner, she's gone, right? Like, she fled the country. What happened?
Yeah, so she is now in Lithuania.
She was forced to take a decision to leave the country, but she had our national visa, which allowed her to be in Lithuania, to be present for 1 year without any restrictions.
She chose to leave because of a threat against either her family or someone else in her team, perhaps. But ultimately, she isn't the reason for these protests. In the end, what this is really about is all this pent-up anger against Lukashenko.
The 65-year-old was quoted by the Belta news agency as saying, "The response will be appropriate. We won't allow the country to be torn apart."
And then ultimately as well, one of the key factors here that people on the ground have told us is his dismissal of the coronavirus, saying that and just treating it as a joke almost, and that kind of has tipped people over the edge.
The protests represent the biggest challenge to Lukashenko's iron grip in years. A harsh response to the rallies could hurt his attempts to mend ties with the West, as relations with traditional ally Russia are strained.
One of the reasons this crisis is so significant is that it's happening on the doorstep of Russia, and that, you know, what happens in Belarus has the potential to cause a crisis between Russia and Europe. And so that is one of the reasons why people are watching it so closely, because Lukashenko has been a close partner of Russia for a long time. And so the question of what happens if he's seriously threatened and what Russia will do is one of the reasons why we're all looking at it so much.
In We talked about the significance of countries like Poland, even further towards Western Europe before. Ukraine, another one right next door. But we have never talked about the possibility of this leader in Belarus going down. Hugely significant moment. We'll see how it plays out. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. Since all of us feel like we are slowly going insane lately, I just want to tell you, if you were afraid to admit that you saw a Halloween candy display in your supermarket, that was real. Your eyes were not playing tricks on you. For the last week, the grocery chain Albertsons has had its Halloween display up in full force. Hershey's has been sending out its Halloween candy 2 to 4 weeks earlier than usual, and a lot of that candy doesn't actually have its standard Halloween wrappers. What it really comes down to is hedging your bets, because companies like Hershey's are realizing they're not sure anyone's going to be trick-or-treating this year.
Where's his Halloween spirit?
Halloween parties? Yeah, don't count on big bowls of M&Ms sitting around. No one really needs one on a family Zoom call. Instead, these companies are trying to get a jump start on people crammed inside their houses who just want to buy a big family-sized bag of candy. Again, just to keep everyone from going bonkers. Mars Wrigley says it is not sending out candy earlier. In fact, it's not sending as much candy to stores, period. Around Easter season, Mars Wrigley says, when it traditionally makes tons of money, there was this avalanche of online orders and they'd already sent out all of their candy. If you're a candy maker, your game plan is just let people eat some chocolate now. Like, it's all they've got. Start here tomorrow. Thank you for those ratings and reviews. They really do help, as well as you posting, tweeting, shouting about us to your friends. We're at Start Here ABC on all the apps. I'm Brad Bilkey. See you tomorrow.